The words are meant to be reassuring. They have the opposite effect. I remind myself that this is what I wanted, and her spontaneous, adventurous nature has always been one of my favorite things about her. It's part of the package of Sage. The problem many people have is that the exact quality that originally attracted them to their partner becomes a threat once a serious relationship begins. After all, this quality was the open door through which the romance started, so now they want to close the door, lock it, and throw away the key before someone else tries to come in after them. So rather than trying to crush Sage's spontaneity, I need to appreciate it. And besides, I've enjoyed a steady stream of new women, so why shouldn't she enjoy some fresh male attention? I need to be more Lawrence about this. I ask her for the flight and hotel information, just in case something happens. The airline, she informs me, is United. And the hotel is Temptation. Temptation? I cry out. What kind of a name for a hotel is that? It's an adults-only hotel, she explains cavalierly. They don't allow kids. I try to be compersive about it. I also make a mental note to research the hotel online. Maybe it's just a place for vacationers who want peace and quiet without screaming children everywhere. Unfortunately, the Temptation website is everything I hoped it wasn't. The banner on it proclaims, topless optional, fun, tempting, sensual. It sounds like a permanent swinger party. I suppose even if she were at a Chuck E. Cheese's resort, I'd still be racked with anxiety. Immediately after I drop Sage off at the airport the following morning, something in me breaks. It is the safety harness tying her to me. I'm shocked and disappointed by my reaction, yet I can't control it. I check the time on my phone anxiously, waiting for the exact moment she's supposed to land in Cancun. Then, 7 minutes after that time, I text to make sure she's okay. Minutes crawl by with no response. Maybe her plane was delayed. Or maybe she doesn't have an international service plan on her phone. Or maybe she's just not thinking about me. To kill time and keep the abyss of maybe from engulfing me, I stop by the post office and pick up my mail. In the stack, there's a letter from my mom marked personal. Our last conversation didn't go well. She said she was searching the house for Viagra and Cialis because she was convinced that my father was having an affair and there was no way he could do it on his own. When I tried to end the conversation, she got upset and hung up on me. So I can only imagine what she must have sent in an attempt to get the last word in. Then I return home and wait. Until finally, 2 hours and 23 minutes after I texted Sage, she responds, "Thanks, I got here safely and am okay." At least she's okay. Okay is better than murdered and stuffed into a dumpster. It's also better than having the best time ever. But the message is so vague. I read it again. There's not one word of affection or emotion. Not even an emoticon. And nothing about the guy she's with. I feel so in the dark. So disconnected. At Lafayette Morehouse, the commune I visited to prepare for my group relationship in the treehouse, I learned two useful terms. One was the concept of getting strange ass, which is when someone in a relationship has sex with a new person. Often, this can add to the passion of the primary partnership. The other was new relationship energy, which refers to the obsession and fantasy that typically accompany a new affair and often feel threatening to someone's primary partner. So I tell myself that she's just going to get some strange ass, that any new relationship energy will eventually fade, and this will make our connection more passionate in the long run. It doesn't help. So I turn to Lawrence again and take him out to dinner, hoping to stay preoccupied, get more support, and absorb some Lawrence-ness. "I've been thinking about what's bothering me," I tell him. It's not that I don't trust Sage. It's that I don't know what Donald's intentions are. Did he take her there as a friend, or because he wants to sleep with her? As I ask the question, the answer seems obvious. I mean, what do you do if you think the guy isn't respecting you, or he thinks he's stealing your girlfriend and somehow better than you? If some dude thinks he got one over on me, it's his idiocy, Lawrence replies. He pauses, probably trying to empathize with someone as emotionally backward as me. Then he adds compassionately, there's definitely a transition period where you have a lot of emotions to work through. So you may have some scary insecurities about whether the other guy is better for her than you, or whether he's using you to connect with her. Just know that it's part of the adjustment process. I suppose it makes sense. It takes time to get good at a new relationship skill, and this definitely is one. It goes counter to practically everything I've ever read, heard, thought about, and observed since childhood. Men aren't supposed to share women. They're supposed to fight and compete over them. Menelaus launched the Trojan War after his wife Helen ran off with Paris. Sir Lancelot's affair with King Arthur's wife led to war between the two. And in numerous tales, from the Odyssey to the Hindu epic Ramayana, men participate in contests to win marriage to a princess or queen. There can be only one victor, not two or three. It's a lot of programming to rewire. But evidently not for Lawrence. Leah's so great, he explains, that I want other people to get the pleasure of experiencing what I get to with her. And I'm so in love with her, I want her to do what makes her happy. It's a beautiful and strangely romantic sentiment. As he speaks, I struggle to change my perspective, to find the pleasure and emotional pain that Corey Feldman discussed, to let my love, not for myself, but for Sage to guide my feelings. And that's when I realize, I don't actually want an open relationship. I just want a half-open relationship. It's completely unreasonable. I want to be with whomever I want, while my partner is stuck with me. I'm clearly not as evolved as Lawrence, as emotionally stable as Pepper, as approval-seeking as James, or as masochistic as Corey Feldman. Maybe I'm not looking for an alternative relationship, but just a selfish, patriarchal one that's hard on her emotions, but easy on mine. I've learned nothing. Chapter 46. On her second night in Mexico, Sage calls briefly from a club to say she's drunk and she loves me. I absorb the word love, greedily, like morphine for my pain. How's it going? I ask nervously. More than anything, I hope Sage will say she's having a horrible time and can't wait to come home. But of course she doesn't. I'm amazed by how much fun I'm having, she yells into the phone. And the guys are treating me like a princess. It's basically the opposite of our relationship. I'm the only girl, and I have two guys with me all the time taking care of me. They gave me a nickname. It's hard to hear her over the music. It sounds like her nickname is Archlow, I ask. Marshmallow. I try to imagine any type of sexual connotation that may have, and draw a blank. It's better than Archlow, which could conceivably be a position that involves two men. We talk for a few more minutes. Then she says she has to go. This club is incredible, she shouts. They brought me behind the screen, and I danced in front of 800 people. Then this dwarf started pretending to hump me. That sounds awesome. I try to be positive. I wish I were there. I don't say the rest of the sentence, so I could chuck that dwarf across the fucking club. So this is what having an open relationship is like. Lying on the couch in your underwear, eating a peanut butter sandwich, while your girlfriend is at a clothing optional resort in Mexico, getting pampered by male slaves and dry humped by dwarfs. I've really been missing out. I want to invite one of our play partners to spend the night, but that would be the definition of addictive behavior, using sex like a painkiller to avoid uncomfortable emotions. Besides, I'm so agitated, I don't think I'd be able to stay present with anyone. I place my sandwich on the floor. I've lost my appetite. A pain shoots through my chest, and I twist my body in agony. It's as if there's an itch in my heart that I can't scratch. I recall the conversation we had at Bliss, in which she said that she'd consider it unmanly if a guy she was dating allowed her to sleep with other men. In giving her freedom, have I lost her respect? I was so sure this was the relationship my life was leading to. But freedom doesn't taste quite as sweet without security. Perhaps this is the flip side of love avoidance. I have a need to feel needed, even if I don't actually like it. I look at the clock. It's only 8 p.m. I have Lorraine's cell phone number. I've never called her out of the blue for help. It seems vain to even consider it. She deals with addicts whose lives are at stake. I'm just an idiot who let his girlfriend go to Cancun with two studly actors. How have you been treating yourself? Lorraine asks when she answers the phone. It's the perfect therapist greeting, one with a message. It is not about what's happening, or what's new, or how life's treating me. Those are things that can't necessarily be controlled. All you can control is your response to them, how you treat yourself. Not so well, I tell her, then explain the situation. She listens without judgment. When I finish, she responds simply, I would recommend becoming a scientist of your own lows. What do you mean? If you're in pain of the heart, enter into the pain and try to find its source, rather than letting the pain drive you, or trying to escape from it, or overcome it. Okay. The empathy in her voice and the logic of her words soothe me. I already feel better. I think it was just a momentary panic, I tell her. Thanks. I'll let you go. Remember that beneath the fear of enmeshment, the love avoidant is secretly terrified of abandonment. That makes sense, I think. Any mother who's enmeshing is also, on an emotional level, abandoning. Just remember, she adds soothingly, that the only people who can be abandoned are children and dependent elders. If you're an adult, then no one can abandon you except you. Thank you, I tell her. I won't bother you again. I'm happy to help. I'll be in LA next month. Let's plan on another dinner with your friend Rick. I'd like that a lot, I say. Did I thank you already? Yes, you did. Thank you. Good night. I hang up, lie back on the couch, and try to dive into the feelings I'm experiencing. They're pretty easy to identify because they're all shades of the same emotion. Fear. The first fear that comes up is that of not being enough, of thinking that Sage is having more fun without me, that these guys are taking better care of her, that she has more in common with them, that they look healthier in bathing suits, that they appreciate her more, that they're better in bed than me. If even half of this is true, then it makes my second fear almost a certainty. Abandonment. Perhaps she's discovering that she's happier without me around. Or even worse, she's barely thinking about me, and the call was just the obligation of a love avoidant acting out of guilt. The third fear is that I'm not cut out for non-monogamy, and I'm a hypocrite who wants to fuck other women but not allow my partner her own freedom. Except I'm not a hypocrite. I actually agreed to this. It's just much harder than I thought it would be. Behind all three fears is the deepest one of all, that Joan in rehab was right, that I have an intimacy disorder and this whole quest has been a symptom of it. I imagine Sage returning to her hotel room drunk, lying on her stomach in the luxurious temptation bed, while her two manservants strip off their shirts and start massaging her. Slowly, she becomes more aroused, raising her hips into a low arch as the men position themselves on either. "Love and let go," I tell myself, the phrase appearing in my mind, the ghost of an old lesson from an old teacher. I take a few deep, calming breaths. Love and let go. Everything I've been complaining about as illogical in monogamous relationships is truly not logical. I was right about that. But what I didn't take into consideration is that it's emotional. My brain knows that whatever Sage is doing won't affect our relationship. And even if it does, then it means it's not the right relationship. But my heart won't listen. Suddenly, I understand why the women in San Francisco agreed to a group relationship in theory, but then seemed to want me to themselves as soon as they experienced it. Before going to bed, I decide to open the letter my mom sent. Inside, there's just a single sheet of notebook paper. I recognize the handwritten numbers on it as my own. It's clearly a punishment I was given as a teenager, though I have no memory of it. I just hold it in my hands and stare at it in astonishment, wondering what kind of person would want her son to write out, "I am a dumb jerk," hundreds of times on lined notebook paper. It doesn't help much, but it explains a lot. When I text Sage the next morning, she doesn't respond. Later, I go to lunch with a colleague who's helping me with the final edit of the Mexican Drug War book, and I'm so tightly wound with stress that I'm barely able to pay attention to what he's saying. Instead, I just wait, listening, straining, praying for the reassuring ping of an incoming text from Sage. As soon as the meal ends, I check my phone messages, just in case one somehow snuck past me. Nothing. And it feels like a javelin hurtling through my chest. She must really be having the time of her life. I commit the cardinal sin of texting her again. Finally, close to midnight Cancun time, Sage texts that she's going to bed soon and will call me from the airport tomorrow. It's a long night. The following afternoon, she phones as promised during a layover. The guys, for some probably shady reason, are on another flight the next day. "I missed you," she says right away. The consoling words achieve their intended effect, and the stress begins to drain out of me. That is, until she speaks the next words. "And don't worry, I didn't have sex with anyone or give anyone a blowjob." Her words are too specific. I instantly assume she gave everyone hand jobs. "I had the best time," she continues. "They love being subservient to me. I think that's their fetish. They enjoy waiting on me and being told what to do and, like, sucking on my toes." I'm instantly creeped out. But what matters, I tell myself, is not how I feel, but how she feels. "Did you like it? It's fun being pampered, and I am attracted to them." Though the word attracted makes me wince, as she keeps talking, I actually do get a jolt of happiness for her. Her boyfriend before me was extremely domineering and controlling, so maybe getting fussed over by subservient men was healing for her. She's such a people pleaser that she deserves having people focused on pleasing her for a change. Immediately following this thought, however, a cold front of negativity arrives. If she likes getting pampered by douchebag Donald and his friend at a cheesy Cancun resort, dancing while being admired by 800 people and one dwarf, and getting her toes sucked by submissive males, then maybe she isn't the right person for me. Compersion is a struggle. It goes against every fiber of my being. I don't know if my resistance to it is cultural or evolutionary or both, but I work to overcome the emotional obstacles. I've done a lot of extreme and experimental things these past few months, and surely I'd be just as likely as her to go to a resort and enjoy getting pampered by two doting women. At least she's honest about it. My ex-girlfriend Lisa once said that every woman wants the same thing in a relationship, to be adored. So Sage had a great weekend of adoration, and maybe this will help me remember never to take her for granted or stop showing my appreciation of her. But then she says, "And I never realized how much we text each other." "What do you mean?" "They commented on it whenever I pulled out my phone." And that's when the dam breaks, when the compulsive adult becomes the wounded child. Before I can stop myself, I punch the wall and scream. I don't even understand why her words hurt so much until a few seconds afterward, when the emotion subsides and the shame kicks in. This whole weekend, when I was suffering because she wasn't texting, I assumed she was just busy having fun. But that wasn't why she didn't text. It's because some guy she was with didn't approve of it. And so the story I hear is that their feelings mattered more than mine, that not being judged by them was more important than reaching out to connect with me. And it pisses me off. "Are you okay?" she asks. "Yeah, but you always could have snuck away to text me, you know." "I know, but I was having such a nice time and in this fantasy bubble, and I was worried that talking to you would somehow ruin it or change things." Another hammer blow. So she purposely disconnected. How can I still feel compersion when I'm now the enemy of her fun? I am the bubble burster. What I want to say in response is, if calling me is that much of a downer, then let's just stop seeing each other. But what I say instead is, I'm glad you had fun, but we need to be better about communication. Other guys shouldn't be telling you what's right or wrong about our relationship, and I can't understand why you'd even listen to them. There is silence on the phone, followed by a guttural staccato sound and rapid aspirating. Shit, she's sobbing. She had a great time in Cancun, and now I'm making her cry. I'm doing exactly what she was worried I'd do. Pop the bubble. No wonder she didn't call me. And no wonder I'm having a shame attack. Guilt is about not being good to someone. Shame is about not being good for her. "Why can't you understand?" she finally pleads. "I needed to do this for me." "I can understand," I respond, "if you communicate." As the words come out of my mouth, I realize I'm repeating the criticism that made her cry. Communication was something I needed, not her. She needed freedom. I'm sure Leah doesn't text Lawrence every few minutes when she's over at some guy's house. "I just unzipped his pants, LOL. I'm licking his ass. It tastes like kombucha. Now I'm fucking him. Miss you." Sage is absolutely right. I would have burst the bubble. If we spoke, I would have felt the need to give my opinion on everything, to make fun of the guys, to somehow control the experience, or make sure she was thinking of me in some way. Like Tommy, with his running commentary when I had sex with his fiancée. No, I don't use rules to control people anymore. Now I just pretend to give them freedom, then use guilt and passive aggressiveness to control them instead. For a guy who doesn't want to be controlled, I never noticed how controlling I actually am. I'm acting just like my long-suffering mom. It's a depressing insight. Rick would probably love to hear it. Healthy, non-monogamous relationships clearly require a high EQ, emotional intelligence, not to mention some seriously secure attachment. And unfortunately, I'm still not there. But it doesn't mean I can't successfully make the transition from half-open to open, from selfishness to selflessness with more conscious practice. This is just the burning period. No one said it would be easy. If I truly want to be compersive with Sage and not a total hypocrite, I need to take Lawrence's advice to heart and understand she's a grown woman who can take care of herself. But, I think immediately afterward, do I actually trust her to take care of herself? Can I even be trusted to take care of myself? "Is there anything else you want to share?" I ask when the boarding announcement for her flight finishes blaring in the background. Mm-hmm, she begins in a timid voice. Did you miss me? Yes, I tell her. I did. Chapter 47. Before picking Sage up at the airport, I meet Adam near his office to swim laps together. I fill him in on the ups and downs of the relationship with Sage. At least it's an honest relationship, he tells me, and that's a good thing. But my question for you is it real? It's a good question, one I've been avoiding. I honestly can't tell you if it will work in the long run, I respond, but it is the most real relationship I've had since Ingrid, and it's everything I said I wanted in rehab, but it's driving me crazy. As we change in the locker room, I ask Adam if he's ever tempted to reach out to the woman he had an affair with. I'll tell you, Neil, I think about her every day, and I can't say that I wish it never happened, because it was the happiest part of my life. That's unfortunate, and on some level, my wife knows that. Adam, and most people, seem to believe that if a relationship doesn't last until death, it's a failure. But the only relationship that's truly a failure is one that lasts longer than it should. The success of a relationship should be measured by its depth, not by its length. We shower, then head to the pool. As we do, we pass a tall, toned woman in a one-piece bathing suit. I'll tell you, he comments, if she threw herself at me, it would be hard to resist. When you're not happy in your marriage, you're vulnerable. So I just stay busy with work, and she stays busy with the kids. He tells me about a book he recently read called His Needs, Her Needs by Willard F. Harley, a clinical psychologist who writes that a man needs five basic things from his wife: sexual fulfillment, recreational companionship, physical attractiveness, domestic support, and admiration. I don't think she's meeting a single one of those, Adam says. What does he say a woman's needs are? I ask. Adam explains that a woman's five basic needs are affection, conversation, honesty and openness, financial support, and family commitment. It seems antiquated to write that a woman needs her man's money, but not his sex, and he needs her domestic support, but not her conversation. However, this seems to resonate with Adam. I get the feeling sometimes that he wasn't looking to be swept off his feet in his relationship, but to have the floor under his feet swept. I gave my wife the book, he laments, and pointed out three pages that explain why I had my affair, just so she could understand the things were missing from our marriage, but she hasn't taken the time to read them. As we ease ourselves into adjacent lanes, Adam tells me that he's had insomnia lately and an itchy red rash on his right hand. The dermatologist said she can give me all the medicine there is for it, but it's stress-related and won't go away until the stress clears up. And that's when I realize he's not a sex addict. You know, I tell him, how they taught us that addiction is something that hurts your life and spirit, that gets progressively worse, and that you can't stop doing even though you know it's not good for you? Yeah, he says. I just realized that you're a marriage addict. I think I am. I just can't let it go for some reason. Maybe you need to go to rehab for that, along with a lot of other married people, he replies and swims off ahead of me. On the way to pick up Sage, I call a few of the other guys from rehab, and only Charles is in good spirits after having evidently cured himself of sex addiction by ending his marriage. I stopped going to meetings, he says in what for him is an upbeat voice, and I've been so happy. I'm like a little kid. I walk with my head up. I look at people. It's like someone turned the lights on, and I don't have this confined, sad feeling that I can't go out and do anything ever again. He pauses and then confides, and I finally finish the game. You approve of it? No, but I used it to meet a woman at the car wash the other day. We're going on a date tomorrow. Chapter 48. They say that absence makes the heart grow fonder, but according to science, even more powerful than the large space between you and the one you love is the small space between that person and someone else. In studies on sperm competition, males ejaculated more and harder after their partner had been with a rival. In her book Mating in Captivity, psychologist Esther Perel advises that the way to keep romance and sex hot in a relationship is through separation, unpredictability, and fear of loss. So theoretically, Sage's return should be the ultimate in hardwired passion and makeup sex. Unfortunately, that's not how it initially goes down. When Sage emerges from customs, she's talking to a man with a deep tan and a gaunt, weathered face. The passionate reunion I've been craving doesn't occur because he stands next to us watching awkwardly. "This is Mike," Sage says after tepidly hugging me. "We met on the plane. He's a director." I try to take the high road. It's not easy because I desperately need the reassurance that even if Mexico wasn't strange ass, it was strange feet and it didn't hurt us. But now there's a random leather-faced guy lurking over us like a bodyguard. "Great," I tell him. Sage acts. "Did you guys exchange numbers?" "Yes, we did," he says. "Well, pleasure meeting you." As we walk to the parking garage, Sage explains. He offered to get me a job on one of his films. "That would be great," I respond. "Let's see if he comes through on that." Then a final twist of the knife. "Guys will say anything to get what they want." Her face darkens. "Maybe he saw something in me that was special." She lingers on the last word and stares at me, as if accusing me of seeing her only as an object of desire and not of talent. And she's right. I wasn't speaking in a spirit of openness. I was speaking to close things, to create doubt, to expose him as a potential fraud, to poison her mind against a possible rival. If I want this openness to work, I need to be more neutral about other men. I'd resent her talking shit about some woman I met. Like Lauren said, she can discover the truth on her own. I don't have to sleep with him. These underhanded attempts at control stop today. Relationships are like divining rods for locating one's faults and weaknesses. As we drive home in awkward silence, I worry about how many of these guys are going to be in our lives now. Phony actors and creepy directors and dirtbag producers who leech on to every fresh female who comes to Hollywood with a dream. A friend once met with a top Hollywood producer who told her he could fast-track her career. He explained that it just involved spending a little extra time with him at night and then with some of his influential friends. When we get back to the house, I kiss Sage and she kisses me back. I lead her to the bed and she follows me. I take off her clothes and she lets me. I go down on her and she spreads her legs for me. I enter her, and she makes sounds for me. The woman who left for Mexico is not the same as the one who came back from Mexico. She isn't making love to me. She's simply agreeing to sex. However, just as I'm about to withdraw in disappointment, she gets on top of me, closes her eyes, and rides me enthusiastically. To anyone watching, such as Tommy, it would look like passionate lovemaking. But I know her too well. Her eyes are shut firmly, and her mind is elsewhere. She's fantasizing about being on top of someone else, I'm sure of it. Maybe one of the guys from the trip, or Leatherface from the plane. So this is what it felt like all those times for Ingrid, when I was connected sexually, but disconnected mentally. "Is everything okay?" I ask as we lie together afterward, so close together and so far away. "I'm fine," she says. "You know what fine means?" "No." "Never mind." She was supposed to have more love to give after these experiences. Her sexuality was supposed to be more alive, intense, and free. But instead, there's less love, less sexuality, less Sage. It feels like I lost her, and I don't even know what I lost her to. Chapter 49. That evening, We walk down the beach to eat at Paradise Cove. The waves gently polish the sand, and the sky sparkles with stars, planes, planets. There's not another person in sight, just Sage and I and the long shadows caught in the beams of our flashlights as we trudge in silence. I feel like I'm leading a prisoner to the gallows, only I don't know what crime's been committed or which of us is guilty. One of the side effects of rehab is that I've become as unhealthily obsessed with people's childhoods as I am with their relationship species. So, as the rain taught us, I look into Sage's relationship with her opposite sex parent for clues to our relationship. And the pattern is clear. When she conformed to her father's unreasonable expectations of her, she was daddy's little girl, until she asserted her independence and he lost his temper with her, often violently. After he threatened to kill her when she was a teenager, she even spoke to a hitman about getting rid of him once and for all. So it makes sense that she molds herself into the perfect girlfriend and takes care of my needs, but then begins to lose herself, grows resentful, and rebels. If this is true, then opening the relationship wasn't about freedom. It was about escape. And that's exactly what she appears to have done. So I'm not actually leading a prisoner to the gallows. I'm leading an escaped convict back to prison. Hopefully, Leatherface isn't a hitman she hired to kill me. Every now and then, the sound of her phone breaks the stillness, and she types a response, until finally, I can't take it anymore. "Can I ask you something?" "Sure," she replies. I don't know how to frame the question without sounding jealous. It may be impossible. So with full awareness that I sound like every woman I've tried to run away from, I continue. "Is there something going on with that guy from the plane?" "What do you mean?" "I don't know, like, did anything happen with him, or did you guys do something?" I struggle to soften the harshness of what I'm thinking. "No, nothing. We just talked." "Is he someone you're interested in dating?" I hate myself for asking these questions. I'm not sure whether I'm trying to find the wall she's built between us so I can tear it down, or so I can use it as an excuse to retreat. Quite possibly, it's both. This is the dance of two love avoidance. Let me tear your wall down so I can build my own in its place. "Well, I think you could be a good connection for me," she replies, "and he did say he'd get me a job, so that would be great." "That would be a good break," I mumble, careful to keep my pledge and let go of control. Meanwhile, my mind plays out every horrible scenario imaginable. They culminate in everything from her crying to me because he kicked her out of the car after she gave him a blowjob, to me at home alone, watching the Academy Awards as she arrives on his arm in an expensive designer dress. Suddenly, Sage's phone pings. She checks it instantly. "Is that him?" I ask. I've lost my grip on the functional adult. I am the wounded child, scared of losing love. "No," she replies. "Who was that then?" I hear my voice asking this, and I'm powerless to stop it. People often say to trust your feelings, but emotions can be even stupider than thoughts. "My sister," she says. I don't believe her. Both my emotions and thoughts agree on this. And so I say something I've never spoken to anyone. The magic sentence capable of destroying any relationship. The four words Ingrid spoke to me shortly before we broke up. "Show me your phone." "No," she says. "Now I'm sure you're lying. Just show it to me." She raises the phone to chest level, and her fingers dance frantically all over it. "Don't delete a single message or we're through." I've made an ultimatum. I've hit rock bottom. Sage wheels around and starts walking back to the house. It's something I would do. Run away rather than face responsibility for my behavior. It's the first thing I did when Ingrid caught me cheating. I told her I'd call her back later. I run after Sage, promise not to get upset, coo everything I can to reassure her, until finally, like a child caught hiding a cookie behind her back, she thrusts the phone toward me. "I'm worried you'll hate me and never want to talk to me again," she says. I brace myself for the worst. My heart is pounding so loudly I feel like it's going to explode. There's no way for this situation to have a good outcome. If he didn't text, then I'm crazy. If he did, then I'm right. And whether I'm crazy or right, something is still wrong with the relationship for us to even be in this situation right now. On her phone, I see dozens of texts from him, all from today. The first one that catches my attention is worse than anything I braced myself for. I've never done anything like that on a plane before. Agony, revulsion, and horror rise in me like vomit. There's another text from him about how they have a magnetic connection that he can't deny. They talked for hours on the plane, she tells me. They had a powerful chemistry, she tells me. His face was so close to hers that they just started kissing, she tells me. It came out of nowhere, she tells me. Next thing she knew, they were in the lavatory fooling around, she tells me. They didn't have sex or remove any clothing, she tells me. She stopped him out of respect for me, she tells me. And then, finally, she tells me that she wanted to wait to discuss it with me, but didn't know how to say it. As the words and tears tumble from her, rough waves of emotions and thoughts crash and collide in me. There is anger because she lied to me. There is jealousy because of the chemistry she had with him. There is disgust because it seems so cheap. There is understanding because it's pretty much what I did with Nicole and how James reacted to it. There is even relief because I wasn't crazy to think there was more to the story than she was telling. And there is fear for so many reasons. I told him about you and our relationship, she concludes. That's why he wanted to meet you in the airport. But chief among these emotions, there is complete and utter bewilderment. How could you? I don't get it, I tell her. Her lower lip starts to quiver. I'm going to make her cry again. I don't care, and I care. We're in an open relationship, I continue. Silence. She fights back the tears and glares at me. You can do anything you want. Her arms fold across her chest in defiance. The only thing I asked for was honesty. Her forehead creases into lines of hatred. You lied to me and cheated on me in a fucking open relationship with no rules. The tears come now, burning with resentment. I am her father. I am the ruiner of fun. I am the enemy of freedom. I am the bubble burster. At least to her I am. But we have a free and open relationship. It was completely unnecessary for her to sneak around and lie to me. That's the whole point of all this. If she just told the truth, then it would have been my responsibility to deal with my reaction to it. But clearly, as my experiences with Nicole and with her French friend Camille should have warned me, an open relationship is no cure for drama and cheating. And Sage did say she'd cheated on her last boyfriend. As I move through all this, Sage stands stiffly, her arms still crossed petulantly. I hug her to reconnect, but she remains stubbornly rigid. I wonder if she feels like I did with Ingrid, enmeshed, overwhelmed, trapped, like running into the water and drowning herself. My first thought is that I need to let this relationship go, but it seems hypocritical to break up with her for cheating when even Ingrid gave me a second chance. And this is the most unrestricted and adventurous relationship I've had so far. Aside from the lying, she's doing it better than I am. I want the freedom to go to Cancun with two beautiful actresses who worship me. I want the freedom to fool around with a strange woman I randomly meet on the plane. In fact, when I flew home from rehab, that's exactly what I was fantasizing about. Besides, it's not like I set up a situation in which Sage was safe to tell me the truth. As soon as we were alone, I was snarky, judgmental, and manipulative. As I pull away, the violence explodes from her. She pounds my chest with her fists and stomps in the sand like a child. I want to be in your arms all the time, she yells. I need that more than anything. I feel like I belong there. She kicks an arc of sand into the air, but I also want to have my cake and eat it. I try to disentangle her words. She wants me, but she doesn't want me. She needs the security of the relationship, but she doesn't want the responsibility of it. She wants my commitment, but she wants her freedom. And slowly, the truth dawns on me. I've gotten what I deserve. Someone just like me. Chapter 50. That night, Sage and I talk for hours, until it seems like we've broken through our walls and can finally see who each other really is. The strengths and weaknesses, the gifts and wounds, the hopes and fears, the mother issues and father issues. Afterward, we have sex with a level of connection and depth that's equal parts intimacy and relief. I'm not sure if it's love. Perhaps we are too wounded to even be capable of loving each other. But it's definitely passion. The sperm competition theorists were right, after all. As I watch her sleep, her cheeks flushed pink with warmth, her light dusting of freckles no longer covered by makeup, and her face bathed in the innocence that belongs to those in slumber, an overwhelming empathy flows through me, and I understand that I just need to embrace her as if she were myself. To expect her to behave no differently than I do in matters of the heart and flesh. Every restriction in my life has been an invitation to a rebellion. It's time to fully and finally commit to freedom and the risks inherent in it, to giving Sage hers and to enjoying mine. 3 days later, Sage goes on her first date, with Mike from the plane. I try not to think of him as Leatherface anymore. That was the old, non-compersive me. That night, I don't ask where she's going or when she's coming home, and I don't text her while she's gone. Leashes are for dogs and leather families. In the meantime, I invite one of our play partners over for the night, and that's when I discover the next challenge of having an open relationship. As Pepper predicted, I feel oddly guilty because I've been so conditioned to believe that sleeping with someone else while my girlfriend is away is wrong, even if my girlfriend is away, probably fucking someone else. To my surprise, Sage returns home before midnight and joins us in the living room, telling me that her feelings for Mike are gone. When I ask why, she says, "I think it's because I've felt filled up by you since our talk." According to Colin, one of the communards I studied with at Lafayette Morehouse, the best way to have strange ass is to be sure the primary woman you're with is totally gratified and you have her agreement. She has to feel she has a surplus of you. In the weeks that follow, Sage and I try to adhere to this dictum. We try to keep each other full. We try to let go of possessiveness. We try to communicate through the inevitable discomfort, fear, and jealousy. And we try not to date others who don't respect our relationship or who want to become our primary. Try is the critical word here, because managing feelings is like taming lions. No matter how successful you think you are, they're still ultimately in control. During a foursome one night, Sage bites my cheek, then disappears into the bathroom and throws a water bottle against the wall. Another night, we visit a bondage club, where some guy who looks like Glenn Danzig spanks and punishes Sage for half an hour. I feel so emasculated as I watch her enjoy being masterfully dominated that I pick a fight with her for no good reason on the way home. And roughest of all, one night Sage goes out with her ex-girlfriend Winter and doesn't return for 2 days. There are times during the relationship when I don't like myself. There are times when I don't like her. And there are times when we're in perfect harmony, sharing our strange-ass stories, then making love one-on-one and finding it much more satisfying. Through the ups and downs, adventures and misadventures, I tell myself that this is just the burning period, that I'm managing powerful emotions like guilt and fear much better as a result of all the failed non-monogamous relationships that led up to this, that comfort is just around the corner. And then one night, as we lie in bed together, Sage turns to me, her eyes glistening, and says, I want to have your child. Though her words are more the result of momentary passion than judicious premeditation, I elatedly wonder if I've actually found it, a relationship that fits all four criteria I laid out when I started this journey. It's not sexually exclusive. It's honest now. It's emotional, and it's capable of developing into a family. Though I wonder what we're supposed to say when our kid walks in the room and sees a bunch of women spread-eagled on the bed. Son, when a man and four women love each other very much. A few minutes later, however, I remember the entirety of the final condition. The relationship has to be capable of evolving into a family with healthy, well-adjusted children. And not only is it still too early in the relationship to know if it's sustainable, but our lifestyle is too intense and unstable for kids to be around it. And without the partying, is this really a relationship? When I call Rick to discuss the viability of getting more serious with Sage, he responds cryptically. Deepak Chopra says that if you want to stop smoking, he begins, you have to change the way in which you smoke. In other words, if you smoke with coffee or after sex, stop smoking with coffee or after sex. Then, when you smoke at other times, really feel all the sensations in your body, and you'll see it for what it really is, putting poison in your lungs. So, what's the analogy for my situation? I ask. Maybe you need to try only having sex with Sage and no one else for a little while, and really feel what it's like to be with her. See what the truth of the relationship is, and if you're real friends with her, or just sex addict friends. That's a good idea, I respond. I'm going out of the country next week, so I'll do it as soon as I'm back. It's a bittersweet trip that I'm not completely looking forward to, hiking Machu Picchu, which I'd originally booked with Ingrid. Why wait until then? He asks. Because Sage is bringing me twins as a birthday present before I leave. God help us all. Chapter 51. Their names are Josie and Jen. They have tiny breasts, tiny noses, and tiny brains. We fooled around with them a few weeks earlier in the bathroom at a hotel suite party. When they arrive, however, a problem becomes immediately apparent. One has a cold sore on her upper lip, and I don't want to risk getting herpes, even for twins. Fortunately, her doppelganger has clean lips. Let's do something you guys have never done before, the safer twin, Josie, says, brightening the mood as she drops onto the couch. I rack my brain to think of something I haven't done before. Nothing comes immediately to mind. Not a single sexual stone left unturned. At least not one that I really want to turn. It's been almost a full year of swing parties, harems, communes, and moresomes. On top of all that, Sage and I have been to S&M dungeons, gangbang parties, orgasmic meditation sessions, and bondage courses in our explorations. I even slept with a twin's mother one night after she emailed me out of the blue. My penis is literally rubbed red and raw from the nonstop activity. Sage, too, seems at a loss. Suddenly, inspiration strikes her. I've never pissed on anyone before, she exclaims. Josie doesn't jump at the opportunity, but she doesn't say no either. However, after a few seconds, Sage realizes, yes, I have. As we rack our brains for something new to do together, Josie leaps off the couch. Where she was sitting, there's a small, spreading, bright red stain. Her period has started. We can always do some coke, she offers apologetically as she makes her way to the bathroom. Sage accepts the invitation. I decline. I don't have a septum anymore. Look, Jen, the twin with the cold sore, says after removing a small baggie from her purse. She pushes on the bridge of her nose, and it squishes flat against her face. Like Michael Jackson, she laughs, except mine's from doing too much coke. It just burned your septum away? I ask, incredulous. Pretty much. Can I touch it? Go ahead. She thrusts her nose toward me proudly, and I mash it like a big wobbly button. One of the most dangerous side effects of cocaine is that it causes people to talk about themselves nonstop, and soon the twins are chattering away about the celebrities they've slept with and the rich men they've used, as Sage hangs on their every word. If the male game is getting sex, they school her, the female game is withholding it. When there's something they want, such as emotional control or financial commitment, they dangle sex just out of reach, creating a finish line that appears to draw closer with every meeting, yet always remains one elusive step away. As Sage nose vacuums the last line of white dust off the coffee table, Jen cackles. That's not a line, it's a chapter. She turns to me. Do you mind if our dealer comes over with more? I press her nose, hoping it works like an off button. Worst birthday ever, I think, as I head downstairs to sleep alone. On the nightstand, there's a tube of Neosporin, which Sage recommended using to treat my friction sore dick. I rub it on, feeling annoyed and neglected. This is what it's like to date my own twin. She's so busy trying to fill the emptiness inside her that she has no time to fill the emptiness inside me. To cheer myself up, I decide to gently masturbate myself to sleep. It's my birthday present to me. I close my eyes, take a few breaths, relax into the pillow, find a comfortable grip away from the tender area, and prepare to sink into fantasy. I try to imagine a woman I'm attracted to and haven't slept with yet, but no one comes to mind. I try to think of a sexual fantasy I haven't experienced yet, but can't come up with a single one. I try to think of something that will turn me on, but I draw a complete blank. I have nothing to masturbate to. I didn't even think this was possible. For the first time in my life, my fantasy coffers are empty. I think back to the challenge Rick originally posed almost 2 years ago. Am I any happier? I've had a lot of excitement, even a lot of pleasure. But I don't think I've truly had any happiness. Researchers at Princeton University did a study on the correlation between money and happiness. As people's incomes rose up to $75,000 annually, their happiness increased. But at incomes beyond that, people on average did not become happier. Perhaps the same is true of sexual partners. Coming on more tits is not going to make me any happier. It seems I've mistaken being out of control for freedom. When I asked Lorraine how I know if this journey was true to my authentic self, she warned, "Wounds bring drama and trauma, not comfort." It doesn't take long to determine what the past year has brought. Albert Camus once wrote, "There is nothing frenzied about debauchery, contrary to what is thought. It is but a long sleep." It is time to wake up. Chapter 52. Quote, "The obvious clinical facts demonstrate that men and women who devote their lives to unrestricted sexual satisfaction do not attain happiness and very often suffer from severe neurotic conflicts or symptoms. The complete satisfaction of all instinctual needs is not only not a basis for happiness, it does not even guarantee sanity." Eric Fromm, The Art of Loving. Chapter 53. A foreign correspondent I met in Haiti while working at the New York Times once told me a story about a colleague of his, which has always stuck with me, although I was never able to independently corroborate it. When he was on assignment in Central America, he was kidnapped by rebels. Government troops discovered their location and planned a rescue operation. Rather than give up the hostages, the rebels decided to kill them. So one of the gunmen pushed the reporter to his knees and pressed a pistol against his head. In that moment of finality, the reporter thought not of his wife at home, but of his high school sweetheart, a woman he hadn't spoken to and had barely even thought of in over 10 years. Suddenly, an explosion shook the shack. Moments later, government forces burst in and rescued him. Afterward, The reporter reflected on that unexpected moment of truth. He had been given a second chance at life, and there was no doubt what he needed to do. As soon as he got home, he called his high school sweetheart. She told him that she was divorced, so the reporter left his wife and married her. As I hike the Inca Trail to Machu Picchu without Ingrid, I can't stop thinking about that reporter's story. It may not be a fairy tale happy ending, but it's a real life happy ending. Life is a test, and you pass if you can be true to yourself. To get the first question correct, all you have to know is who you are. A life is just one letter away from a lie. I originally invited Adam to join me, but his wife said that if he was going to take a vacation, it should be with the whole family. Then I tried Calvin, who said yes and made plans to go to Brazil afterward to see his son. Sage also wanted to come, but the trail permits were already sold out. "I have a favor to ask," Calvin begged just before the trip. "Make sure I don't go mongering in Peru." "I promise," I told him. Then I searched mongering online until I found his particular definition of the word: whoring, especially in a foreign country. For the first couple of days, the walk is uncomfortable, not just because of the length of the trek and the steepness of the ascents, but because I had sex with Sage before I left, and the skin on the shaft is blisteringly red from overuse and stings from the slightest touch. Whenever I change clothes, I have to cradle it gently, like a broken bone. There's Neosporin in my first aid kit, so every few hours when I take a break to pee in the underbrush, I surreptitiously rub some on. Calvin and I are accompanied by a mandatory guide, Ernesto, a squat Andean man with legs sculpted from a lifetime of hiking these mountains. As we tramp mostly uphill, through arrows of rain and blankets of heat, chewing coca leaves to ameliorate altitude sickness, our minds clear, and we share our dreams, fears, and ambitions. There is, however, a space between us where something is missing. It is just big enough to fit Ingrid. And with every peak that juts through the clouds, every ruin that emerges in the clearing, every smell that perfumes the morning dew, I wish she were there to share it. I don't think about Sage being here and seducing random female hikers into camping threesomes. I can just imagine her asking the guide how to turn coca leaves into cocaine. To my surprise, since snapping out of my decadence-induced stupor on my birthday night, I'm not even worried about what she's doing at home and who she's doing it with. "So how have you been doing with the mongering?" I ask Calvin as we reach a small plateau. "It's been a while. I haven't seen an escort in probably 6 months." "Maybe that's because you were living with one." "I think that's what ruined it for me," he says. "For my birthday, Mariana dressed up like the day we met and thought it would turn me on, but it repulsed me. I didn't want anything to do with it." He stuffs a handful of coca leaves into his mouth and continues. "The odd thing is that since I stopped, I've been drinking a bit and getting angry at people who don't follow the rules, like if they don't use their turn signals to change lanes." We walk in silence for a while as the forest screams with life around us, both probably thinking about how his behavior supports the addiction theories he supposedly disproved. "I have a weird dream last night," Ernesto says softly. "What was it?" I ask. "I should not say it, maybe." To make him more comfortable, I share one of mine. "I've been having this recurring dream lately where I'm playing soccer, and I'm visualizing the penalty kick that's going to score the winning goal. But when the time comes for the actual kick, I barely connect with the ball, and it dribbles just a few feet in front of me. And every time, I'm jolted awake by my feet kicking the sheets." "Bad dream," Ernesto replies. "Your mind, it knows the right thing to do, but your body, it doesn't listen. Maybe I tell you mine." He lowers his voice, even though there's no one around us. "So, I dream that a girl from the Amazon is in Cusco to look for me, and I am very worried that my wife finds out she is there. Were you worried because you'd slept with her? An affair, yes. Is this girl someone you're seeing in real life? He hesitates, then responds tersely, yes. We discuss his affairs and all the others his friends have when they leave their homes to work as guides and porters. There's a book I want, he says. It is about strategies for these women. Very helpful. Is it the game? Calvin asks. No. We pause to lean against a large outcropping of boulders, drink water, and wipe sweat while he searches his memory for the book's name. Then suddenly, it comes back to him. I think it's called How to Cheat. Men everywhere, it seems, are the same. As the hours pass, my lifelong antipathy to jogging and unnecessary walking catches up with me, and I tire and fall behind the guys, sweat prickling my sun-roasted neck. Calvin and Ernesto clear a ridge, and when I reach it 10 minutes later, I don't see them. I trudge on, but soon my head starts to spin. I feel incorporeal, like at the beginning of my ecstasy trip, but with the addition of a headache. Maybe it's dehydration, or altitude sickness, or exhaustion, or all three. I pull the water bottle from my bag and drain the small puddle that remains. I slow to a zigzag trudge, worried that I'm going to veer off the ledge and tumble into the valley far below. And I wonder, if I collapsed right now and I needed someone to get help before dehydration or heat stroke or pulmonary edema killed me, which of my current or former girlfriends could I rely on? My ex-girlfriend Katie would probably get angry at me for abandoning her by collapsing. My ex-Kathy would start hyperventilating and I'd end up having to rescue her. And Sage? I imagine that she'd stay by my side. But for how long until she got restless, began worrying about what she was missing by being there, and took off to save herself? Only Ingrid would stay with me, trying to find help until my dying breath. Ingrid. In that moment, the dizziness briefly lifts, and with my lungs full of crisp, smog-free air, with my vision clear and unobstructed by advertising, with my ears open and unclogged by chatter, with my mind clear and unclouded by distractions, a thought I've been trying to keep buried charges to the surface of my mind on a tidal wave of emotion. I blew it. Sex is easy to find, whether through game, money, chance, social proof, or charm. So are affairs, orgies, adventures, and 3-month relationships, if you know where to look and are willing to go there. But love is rare. I was so blind, I really thought that when I broke up with Ingrid, it was about wanting freedom. I didn't see at all, despite everything I'd learned, that it was about not wanting to be loved so much. I did exactly what Lorraine warned me not to. I let the grounded adolescent run my life. Whatever I have with Sage, it is not love. She molds herself into the perfect partner for me because she wants something back. Affection, attention, and whatever little social status comes from being a writer's girlfriend. And I mold myself into the perfect boyfriend because I want the sexual adventures. Maybe the reason I didn't take Rick's Deepak Chopra advice is because if I did, then I'd see the relationship for what it is. Not poison like smoking, but immature like breaking up with your wife and buying a sports car after finding your first gray hair. Except if married men have midlife crises, men who haven't ever truly been able to commit have no life crises. And if they're able to see clearly for even just a moment, they start to realize that they're losing more than they're gaining each day they remain stalled on the scenic road of growing up. When I finally huff up to the mountain pass, I see two figures sitting just on the other side of it, Calvin and Ernesto. I drop my backpack to the ground, collapse in the shade, and swallow Ernesto's water and Calvin's aspirin. Then I wait for my body to return to equilibrium. Though it was more a brush with discomfort and anxiety than with death, there's one thing I didn't think about in that moment of truth. The wild foursome with Sage, Leah, and Winter. No, I thought about Ingrid. I thought about returning the sports car, going home, and begging for forgiveness. At the campsite on our final night, as Ernesto, Calvin, and I drink tea and snack on Andean guinea pig under the swaying glow of a lantern, I pull out a deck of skitty kits and suggest a game, hoping it will distract me from my thoughts. I wish Ingrid were here, I sigh to Calvin. She'd love playing skitty kits with us right now. Calvin mumbles something noncommittal. He's probably sick of me whining about her. And she's so funny, I continue. By now we'd have dozens of private jokes. You saw how she lit up the table when she came to rehab. I hope I haven't blown it. You'll get back together with her, Calvin says matter-of-factly. I know it. I hope so. I close my eyes, and a deep sense of despair overwhelms me. What's the fun of hiking Machu Picchu? Of walking a trail carved centuries ago? Of waking to see the sun cresting over a mountaintop and the clouds below? Of eating Andean cuisine and playing skitty kits in a tent underneath the glow of a lantern, if I can't share it with someone I love? That is the price of freedom. As we begin our descent to the lost city of Machu Picchu the following morning, the reception indicator on my phone returns to life with a single bar. And I text Ingrid, "Freedom!" Chapter 54. After I send the text, followed by another letting her know Machu Picchu has no magic without her, a surge of familiar fear comes over me. That night, I dream of having a threesome with two random tourists. Why won't my libido leave me alone? Before checking my phone for Ingrid's response, I try to steady my nerves. So many people much wiser than myself, Prince Charles, Bill Clinton, General Petraeus, have cheated on their wives. Can I really hope to succeed where the world's leaders have failed? I don't know. But what I can do that they didn't is make the choice to be honest, to communicate my vulnerabilities with Ingrid, and to get support if I'm struggling. Fuck my doubting mind. I can do this. I check my phone. Nothing. But I know in my heart that she'll keep her word from what seems like so long ago. When we reach the fabled city, nestled among the mountaintops, there's still no response from Ingrid. Nor is there one when the sun sets. Maybe she didn't get it. Maybe I misspelled freedom and didn't use the right number of E's. Maybe she's happy with her new boyfriend. Maybe she's forgotten about me. Maybe I made a mistake. Definitely, I made a mistake. Chapter 55. The next day, there's still no response from Ingrid. Chapter 56. The following day, nothing. Chapter 57. The day after that, I realize she's never going to respond. That night in the spaceship room, I told Ingrid I needed time to explore and learn and make a choice. And finally I've made it. That love is not like roulette. You can't bet on a spread. As I'm packing to return home on my last night in Peru, I receive a message not from Ingrid, but from my ex-girlfriend Kathy, who says she urgently needs advice. Like Ingrid, Kathy was abandoned by her father, who was caught living in secret with another woman and other children. When I call, Kathy explains tearfully that her ex-boyfriend Victor was recently diagnosed with liver cancer. He's a notorious player from Miami who broke up with her because he wanted to fuck other women. But while he was delirious on medication in the hospital, His family said he kept calling out her name. When Victor regained his senses, the doctor told him the cancer had advanced so much that at age 44, he had only 3 months left to live. Victor didn't react to the news by deciding to go on a fucking spree for his last days on Earth. He didn't get a bunch of women together so he could experience the wildest foursome ever. Instead, he told his family, "That's what I get for being a player all my life. I need Kathy. I need to apologize to her." "So," Kathy continues, "he called me last night and asked me to go to the Caribbean with him. He said he wants to spend the days he has left with me." "What'd you tell him?" "I told him I needed time to decide. He threw my love away when he wanted to have fun, and now that he's dying, he wants me back. I'm scared it's going to be too painful to get close to him again and then lose him again." "You're right. It would be good for him to have you there, but it wouldn't be healthy for you." And that's when I understand why Ingrid hasn't called back. It's predictable, even stereotypical, that a love avoidant like me would hit a bottom and reach out to the love addict, only to start the cycle anew and waste another year of our lives. Or that a love avoidant, as soon as his next girlfriend says she wants to have a family together, would start pining for the one who got away. As for my big Machu Picchu epiphany, while the longing for Ingrid may have been real, everything else about it was pitiful. Love isn't about wanting someone to save my life, or see a vista with me, or make me laugh, or any of those selfish reasons I've always given for loving Ingrid. Those are just things she can do for me, or ways she can make me feel. Love is... Actually, I have no idea what love is. Ingrid's right. She's doing what's healthy. I'm not. All I've got is a healed dick and a defective heart. Chapter 58. When I return home, I receive a wedding invitation in the mail. I check the calligraphy on the back of the envelope. It says, De La O, Ingrid's last name. My muscles go weak, and I drop the card to the ground. I am a dumb jerk.
Door 4. Anhedonia. Stage 1. Emptying out. William, you must be very lonely. Do you know what it is you're searching for? Kioma, myself, I guess. I don't know. I need to find out who I am, to give the simplest of my actions a reason. I know my being in this world has some significance, but I'm afraid when I find out what it is, it'll be too late. In the meantime, I'm a vagabond. I keep traveling. Even when the earth sleeps, I keep traveling, chasing shadows. Kioma, directed by Enzo G. Castellari.
Chapter 1. You set out to do something, and you did it. You accomplished everything you ever wanted. You had every single kind of sexual adventure and relationship you ever dreamed of, and you're still not happy or fulfilled. The voice is wise, the voice is cruel, the voice is right. It belongs to Rick, who sits at the Italian restaurant Giorgio Baldi in his uniform of white t-shirt, black shorts, and frayed loafers. That's because he hasn't been in any relationships with real intimacy. He's one up, and they've been way one down. They're toys. He won't get hurt playing with a toy, but these women, they will. This voice is also wise. It is also cruel and right. It belongs to Lorraine.